So this is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air for the first time at Barkley. And we wanted to welcome you to the show. How are you doing today, this morning?
I'm doing great, thanks.
So we also want to mention that we are on Newsly. It's an iOS host. You can receive 1 month free premium subscription so you can stop scrolling and start listening. Newsly allows you to have alerts and your favorite podcast and webcast Newsly, so you can listen to us after. So we do welcome you to the show. You're talking to us from Australia with the magic of technology. We're in New Hampshire, United States, and that's pretty cool to be able to talk to people all over the world. And you are very in terms of some interesting practices. One of the things that you mentioned was a mold toxicity master practitioner and a psychoneuroendoimmunology practitioner, and a bunch of other types of practitioners, which I might not know enough about. So maybe we can start as to why did you get into these type of practices?
Well, it all started through my own health journey, not knowing what the trauma as a child and a teenager and then through my adult years was doing to me. Find it at the last minute. Pretty much the last minute. So having numerous conditions that were threatening my life and really looking at not just what are these conditions doing now, but what's contributed to them? How did I get here? And so throwing myself into study, that's how I found all the things that I now do in my practice. And, you know, I'm really lucky that I am here today, and it's through a whole lot of hard work by a whole lot of great people. And yeah, here we are today.
It's interesting because in my life, I had cancer. Like when I was 27, I had a level 3 sarcoma on my back, and I survived it, not using holistic medicine, but I had chemo and radiation. You know, I was 27. I didn't know any better to use anything else. But my wife just recently in the last year had that she had to go through radiation and also go through chemo. And it's, you know, you don't normally run into people that run into the same type of cancer in the same lifetime. But, you know, yeah. I am somewhat familiar with that type of situation. So when did that happen to you? And it really did change your life, right? In terms of the direction that you started to make.
Yeah. So in 2014, 2015 is when I was battling with my cancer. And it was stage 4. So it had already gone to my lymph nodes. It was already spreading. And wow. I did the surgery. I didn't have much of a choice, but I did the surgery. I didn't do the chemo and radiation, though, because it just wasn't congruent for me. And I thought, do you know what? Everything I'm learning and studying about chemo and radiation doesn't feel right for me. I'm not saying it's not right for everyone, but for me, it wasn't right. And so that's when I threw myself into looking at what nature could do, looking at what nutrition could do, you know, looking at what the other alternatives were. And, you know, I'm lucky enough, here we are, it's currently 2022, and, you know, I check my stats every year. I do full blood workup and everything, and I'm in great condition. I didn't think I'd be here, to be honest, even once they did the surgery. I thought, well, this is a tough fight, and I'm not sure I'm going to win, but here I am.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very significant thing. When I was 27, I had a level 3, not as bad. For a 27-year-old who was having any kind of cancer, I was like, wow. And I hadn't smoked. I hadn't done anything. I didn't do drugs. It wasn't in my family history at all. It seemed like it came from the environment. And I did a bunch of research after the fact, and it seemed like I might have gotten it from being in a water source that would with carcinogens that got on my skin. So, do you know the source of your cancer? Was it hereditary?
Know the source. It certainly wasn't hereditary. But in the household that I was living in, strangely enough, two of my pets developed cancer at the same time as me. So, and one was a cat. Her name was Shimmer.
You think it,
Yeah, I think it was environmental and emotional. So Shima had a cancer in her toe. We had her toe removed, and then a year later, like, she got a big bulb tumor on her face. And that was around the same time as mine. And our dog also had a sarcoma. So, I think there was a lot emotionally that was going on prior to all of our cancer diagnosis in the family. That had something to do with it. It was also environment. We had just moved from a town that was very close to a refinery, and there was, very high autism rates, very high cancer rates in the town. And, we'd then moved towns and everyone got their diagnosis. So there was a lot of contributing factors for us, but I certainly wasn't alone in my family at the time. And, I'm blessed that it wasn't affecting my kids personally, but just watching my pets go through it was hard enough.
It's very hard because I did research after my cancer and started studying like volatile organic compounds like VOCs. And I found in the neighborhood I had lived in, it was in the suburbs, but there had been agricultural, farms that go back to the 1800s, and they had these trash pits. And in the trash pits, they had all kinds of chemicals. They would just dump everything into the trash pit, and it got into the water tables, got into the wells, got everywhere. So I started doing a lot of research and saying, wow. And this is something people didn't want to talk about. Like people who owned the property didn't want to say that the property was like, oh, that then we're gonna say it's like a, some kind of EPA disaster area. So there was like property owners that don't want to admit they had the problem. People don't want it. Companies that had, dumped it, farms, commercial farms that didn't want to take responsibility. So there's a lot of factors. And then, with the emotional things going on in my family too, that I was having, like, there was a combination, I think, like your emotional state, the environment. But how did you find holistic natural health as a your solution? Because a lot of people, like me, I went with totally what the medical field told me because I didn't know anything else at the time.
I'd already been let down for years by the medical field. So my cancer didn't just sneak up on me. For years prior, I had been going to my general practitioner or GP, as we call them here in Australia. And, I'd said, something's wrong. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. I think it's my thyroid. Something's wrong. And I was dismissed. I was told I was crazy. I was attention seeking. There's nothing wrong. They ran the usual suspect blood tests, and it all came back within range, which they usually often do. And so here I was, stuff was happening, and I was watching what my body was telling me, going, other people don't do this every day. Like, this isn't right. So I'd already, been I guess exposed to being dismissed by the medical fraternity. So when they said, okay, so you're stage four, we really don't have any time to waste here. We need to cut it, we need to radiate it, we need to do chemo. I'm like, I don't think so. I don't think I trust you guys anymore. And like I said, I really didn't want the surgery. I had to. I was going through quite a nasty divorce at the time. And my lawyer basically said, if you don't get the surgery, they're going to paint you as the irresponsible parent, because you're not taking your health seriously. So I really had no choice. But that's where I drew the line. I went, okay, you've taken the main cancer out. Now it's up to me. So, like I said, I'd had years of exposure to mainstream medicine and just not gotten the answers, or just not even had the experience of being heard. Not everyone's in the same boat. That was my experience. So I guess that's what led me into looking at holism, what the whole body tells you, what nature can provide, minerals from the dirt, all that kind of good stuff. And, I'm really glad that I did.
Yeah, I think that it's a really interesting thing because did you find it was because you're a woman that you said it was a fraternity that a lot of the doctors were men and they didn't actually hear you? Is that
Yeah,
what you?
definitely.
Yeah, and is basically they don't listen to women's health issues. That is like why a
They
lot of in the States we've got a lot of female doctors that have become very specialized because of that very reason. that a lot of women feel like the men doctors don't listen to women, dismiss them all the time, and don't actually hear what they're saying.
Yeah, definitely. So in the town that I lived in, there was two medical practices and there was only two women. So one in each practice. And when I say fraternity, it was mainly men. And so, you know, I actually did see one of these female doctors and I said to her my experience. And, you know, she started looking at hormones and that kind of thing. And then she referred me to go and get a hysterectomy. Well, that's not the problem. Yeah, my hormones are gone crazy, but that's not the problem. That's a symptom. So, you know, if I'd known back then what I know now, I would have, you know, headed all off at the pass. But again, you know, the outdated teachings of these doctors in this town, I'm not saying all doctors, but, you know, of the doctors in this town was and sadly this is quite a widespread theory, let's just fix the hormone imbalance and not look at why it's happening.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a very old school way of thinking. I think my mom had, my mother was, you know, she's in her 90s now, and she had, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, that's what the doctors did. And they still do it. And from what you're saying, they're still doing it.
They're still doing it. And do you know what? The human body is a marvelous creation. And there is not one single organ there that is useless. You know, we see often, let's rip out the appendix, let's rip out the tonsils, let's rip out the uterus, let's, you know, just cut, burn, poison kind of mentality. But the human body, every piece is needed. You know, I have a friend who recently, you know, contacted me and said, oh, I had to have my appendix out. And I said, why? Oh, because I had some pain. But the appendix is needed. Like, it's part of a couple of different systems and it's needed. Oh, no, the doctors told me they could just whip it out. It wasn't necessary. Yeah, it was an excess organ. Like, if it was an excess organ, why is it even there? That doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a lot of doctors today, like my wife is very much into whole health. And one thing that we found is, like, when I had cancer, and I got out of it, there was no talk about nutrition. There was no talk about maybe you should change what you eat, right? Maybe you should change the things you put on your skin. Maybe you shouldn't use as many chemicals. Maybe you shouldn't use pesticides. Nobody was thinking about anything. Like you have to eat. And where is nutrition? And a lot of doctors' practice, they don't, you know, if you're a diabetic, they don't really tell you that much. They might send you to a nutritionist, but they don't even tell you that much. You really have to, you know, in the way the world is, you know, what we are given to eat is coming from like multinationals that don't really care, right? And they put all kinds of things in it that might be causing your problem. And so when you really start to research after you have a significant disease, it's like, hey, I need to get all these ingredients that shouldn't be coming into my body and get rid of them. So was that part of what you started to do?
Yeah, definitely. And when we're looking at nutrition, you know what most dietitians, doctors, even some naturopaths are basing everything on is the food pyramid, the standard food pyramid, which was created in the US. And it was created with or in conjunction with the meat, dairy, and wheat board. Was actually paid for by them. It changed a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, it's a triangle and it says you've got to eat a whole lot of grains and a whole lot of meat and a whole lot of dairy. But that's actually incorrect. Nearly every single human being cannot tolerate dairy. And for all the people out there watching or listening going, well, I drink milk and there's no problem. Actually, there is. It is the most inflammatory food possible. And if you have any type of inflammation, which you will, you're contributing to that. And, you know, we see a lot of studies, especially with people on the autism spectrum, where, you know, gluten-free, dairy-free foods are recommended. Okay, but just because it's gluten-free doesn't mean it's glyphosate-free. And you were talking about chemicals. Why are we putting Roundup on foods that we eat? when it's one of the deadliest chemicals known to man. Yeah, Monsanto, thank you very much.
The same reason why they tell farmers they can't use seeds. You know, they'll patent seeds and then sue a farmer and saying, you've got our seeds in your field, so now you got to cut all that down. You can't use your own. You can't grow what you were growing.
And so, there's a worldwide push to outlaw heirloom organic seeds. Why? Ask yourself why.
Well, Monsanto wants you to buy theirs.
So, but you know, the same thing with the cow that we eat, the beef. Okay, that is eating grass that is treated for high yield grass. Okay, here in Australia, we have a type of grass called Phalaris. And the only thing that can eat Phalaris and not get sick is a cow. Even sheep can get very sick. And here we have kangaroos. Kangaroos eat it because it's been sown everywhere. The seeds have gone everywhere and it's very drought resistant. So just a sprinkle of rain and this grass pops up. Kangaroos eat it and they go absolutely neurologically haywire. And they're tumbling around and they look like they're drunk and they think they're eating the grass, but they're, you know, 2 feet off the ground. And they think they're cleaning their babies in their pouches, but the babies are dying in the pouches because the mum is just hallucinating everything in her life. And, you know, this has all come from sowing this Phalaris grass for high yield for cattle. It is not good for anyone else, and it's not good for us. We're now eating that cattle. Okay, the cow has, you know, all those stomachs to churn this around and not get the toxic effect, but the toxins are going into the meat and humans are now eating that meat. Now, no one's even talking about or doing any studies on the effects of Phalaris poisoning down the chain as a meat product. So why aren't we talking about this? Why aren't we understanding that what our, you know, our livestock are eating comes to us? It doesn't just end with them when they die and they become steak. You know, that's not where the story ends. It's what nutrients are you getting from that? What toxins are you getting from that? And I think this needs to be a bigger discussion. I think certainly now it's time, it's beyond time, that as humans we stop putting our head in the sand of the chemicals that we're taking in and where did our food sources come from. Yeah. You know, you mentioned toxicity in the home. We're surrounding ourselves with chemicals and, you know, VOCs.
Yeah, I mean,
we're getting new furniture. Yeah, and we're sitting straight on it. Why aren't you, when you buy a new couch, sitting it in the carport for 3 weeks, you know?
Yeah, there's fumes coming off of everything. Like everything we buy, because there's so many volatile organic chemicals, or it's based on a petrochemical, right? Yep. So if you had the world be like, you know, being fed by the big almost selling plastic everywhere, which has gone and polluted the ocean and then polluted everything else. That's why when I was 27, I started to really look at VOCs. I started to look at plastics. I started to look at what was going on. And I really, because I live in New Hampshire, we have a lot of organic farmers that have very small yield, very specific, you know, because we still are a kind of a farm state, but a small farm state, not like the big Midwestern, like super, super corporate farms. These are like mom and pop for real. They're not part of the corporate structure, and they've got heirloom vegetables. They've got very small yield, you know, animals, bison, you know, and all kinds of really cool stuff that you can get, like, you know, turkeys. Free-range turkeys that are living in a really kind of pristine area that wasn't hit with like Dow chemicals or Monsanto, and they're pushing that, and it's one of the reasons I live in New Hampshire as a cancer survivor, because I wanted to be in an environment that had less pollution, because it's outside the city, it's like in a big pine forest area with a lot of natural lakes and stuff. So I just made a choice to not live in the big city. You know, and to get away from that, to kind of try to not get hit with it again.
Yeah. You know,
but I'm 55 now, and I kind of made it so far.
And I think, you know, this is something that we need to get across here to the listeners. If you don't have the opportunity to live in a paradise, you know, like that, then do what you can in your own environment. Reduce your chemicals in the home. Look at your hygiene products. If you can't eat it safely, why are you putting it on your skin or on your hair? You know, look at everything that you're bringing into your home and look at all these things that are off-gassing. Why aren't you sleeping with a window open every night, no matter what the weather? You know, why are we sealing our homes up full of these chemicals and full of condensation, which leads to mold? And why are we not letting airflow through? When did it become that we needed to put a heater or a cooler on rather than actually experience temperature? When did it become that we had to seal our houses up rather than experience airflow? And, you know, I'm going to sound like a tinfoil hat wearer now, but look at the conspiracies behind it. Look at the agendas behind it. Is all of this for your benefit? Start asking questions. Well,
you can kind of track it. Like, if you're going to have to seal up your house, then you got to run that electricity and run that air conditioner and run that heater, like, more often than probably what you would have done. Yeah. And maybe you're not wearing the clothes to kind of deal with the natural temperature, that wear, you know, extra set of clothes or less clothes, you know, and you're just trying to control the environment. And then you're, like you say, you get all this VOC fuming coming off of everything. And you're, and you wonder why you're getting sick, and you wonder why you're getting all these, you know, all these autoimmune diseases. It's like, why is that happening? Because people are just getting all this processed food. They're taking all these, you know, all these, you know, pharmaceuticals for, you know, everything you read, it has like 10, you know, 1,000 like side effects.
I know, so
you
right?
take this, you have to take something else, and then you take something else to deal with the side effect of that. So it's a cascading effect, and suddenly you've got a big medicine cabinet full of things. They've got, well, I got to take this to deal with the after effect of this one, and after effect of that one, and the next one.
Definitely. You know what? If you're taking something or you have something in your home and it has a poisons warning on the bottle, question it. You know, like, that can't be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a type 2 diabetic, so I'm kind of stuck with insulin. And, you know, I do have to deal with it. Now, but I've been able to reduce how much I have to take by doing a lot of exercise. And I've got it down to, I'm almost going to be off of it. Just because, you know, having to be in, at the mercy of the companies that are charging crazy money for insulin, like, I don't want to be at the mercy of having to spend like a $600 a dose.
Yeah.
Because that's what the world, the way they want it to be. They want you to be, you know, in bad shape, so you have to take that $600 dose. When if you do things right, you might not have to. If you actually exercise more, you eat right, you get rid of all the carbos, and you do all the things right, you can get off of these things and not be so dependent.
Exactly. That, like I said, the human body is amazing. We just have to give it a chance to work for itself. But the more that we do by, you know, taking a pill or by eating a packaged food or, you know, heating the crap out of the food and taking all the nutrients out, then the more we're relying on having to add things in for the body to do these basic functions, because we're not allowing it to work the way it's intended.
So one thing I was reading about some of your questions, which I think people would probably need to understand. So what is the PNEI of trauma? Maybe you can explain that concept.
Yeah. So PNEI is the psychoneuroendoimmunology of trauma. And it links four particular systems together, and they work together a lot. So no system in the body works alone. These four work together. So P is the psycho. It's your limbic center of your brain. It's your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. When a traumatic event happens, we think or we feel something or we attach an emotion to it. Our neural or nervous system then jumps in and it takes those messages around the body. So trauma is no longer experienced just in the brain. It's now traveling through the body. The endocrine system, so your hormonal system, then has to react. So you might feel a bit hot, a bit flushed, a bit clammy, a bit dizzy, a bit nauseous, whatever it may be. And then your immune system jumps in and it has to categorize all the, you know, actions along the line, and it creates an immune response. And we often see autoimmune as the response. So immune system has two layers. It has the innate and then the acquired. Both of those need to respond to a threat. So your body's whole idea is to keep you safe. Here's four systems that do not deem you safe from a trauma. So it's really interesting how the body can react to something. Something that can happen like in our, you know, early days can carry on into our 50s. And we don't really see how or why, or maybe we don't remember the event, but our body does. So that's what the PNEI is.
Wow. It seems like the modern life is forcing, causing us all these autoimmune system things to happen, because we've kind of been detached from nature, or we're detached from the idea of what we should do. And we have so many artificial things. And so many things that we do, you know, like you said, you dismiss the appendix, you dismiss all these things. Oh, I don't need it, right? I don't need to do that. So, and then you also dismiss like old indigenous practices. Oh, yeah, they didn't understand stuff. Like, well, I'm part Blackfoot Indian, part Cherokee Indian, and when they were living here in America, they kind of knew how to live in America without chemicals.
Yeah.
with the natural state of the way America was, right? And they didn't need all these things, right? They could actually live in the environment and live pretty good, and live pretty good long age. And you're like, well, how can they do that? Well, because they were actually kind of in sync with so you see, that's why we have what we have. Why we have all these problems. I mean, is that your kind of from what you've been doing?
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, I'm really looking into Indigenous Australians and how did they work with land? How do they still work with the land? And I've spoken to a few elders, and, you know, what they're telling me is so beautiful. And, you know, the original people of Australia have Dreamtime stories, and it talks about, you know, in that they talk about animals and spirits and the land and, you know, what's provided. And I think we need to really look at these First Nations cultures and just say they have so much wisdom. We don't want to steal that wisdom, but we want to pay, you know, credence and homage to them and just go, there's something there. We need to go back to those ways. And, you know, I'm just so grateful for all the First Nations people across the world, for their knowledge, for their experience, for their culture, for their tradition, because I think there is so much we can learn.
Well, I think a lot of what we, you know, the pharmaceutical industries did look at what a lot of these Indigenous people did, but then they kind of hyper over exaggerated it and made it like poisonous. Yeah. So it's always like you took that knowledge, but then you turned it into like a corporate strategy to like hook people, to make it too powerful and poisonous, to the point where it's okay, you know, you had a different goal. You actually didn't want to heal. You got a monetary profit goal. So you got to understand, like, some of these people, like, what they do is not necessarily do no harm. You know, they don't always have your best interest. And that's, you know, as a young kid getting cancer, when I started looking into stuff, I said, well, these people, I assumed had my best interest at heart. And then I found out they were being motivated by other things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I was the same with my cancer diagnosis. You know, they're telling me take all these medications. And I'm like, well, why? Why do I need to take them? And I looked into kickbacks that doctors were getting for prescriptions here in Australia. And I looked at, you know, the golf club trips that they were getting, and, you know, country club trips and things like that. I'm like, okay, this isn't about my health. This is about what you can get. And I think, you know, we really need to take things back to basics, and we need to go back to, you know, my hope is we can go back to the health practitioner that knows everyone in the town, that knows your kids, knows your parents, you know, and has your community's best interest at heart. And I know here in Australia, there's a big push to have, you know, like safe harbour houses dotted around so that you can go and you can, you know, get food there and you can make social connections there. And, you know, there's health and wellness facilities. And I think that's kind of what we need to get to, is where we were maybe 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, like with like the doctor that could visit your home, or you know, it wasn't part of some corporate structure that has a corporate strategy to either give you care or not give you care, or give you ration care, or make it one size fits all. You know, being an African American, you know, in America, like what works for African Americans doesn't necessarily work for other people, right? Yeah. There's certain diseases that we get more than other people, and there's certain things that, like, if you make that drug, it doesn't necessarily work on us, right? And you think it does, and it doesn't. Or, you know, so there's a lot of things where you have to actually start to look at people individually and different ethnic groups and say, hey, this is actually causing harm, and it's not just, you know, going to work for everybody. You have to actually go to the individual and start doing individual level diagnosis, not just group level diagnosis.
Exactly. And do you know what? If your practitioner isn't asking an absolute ton of questions about your history, then they're not getting the full picture. You know, if you're just going in to a doctor or a naturopath or whoever, and they're saying, okay, what are we dealing with today? What about what you've been dealing with for the past 50 years? You know, there's history there that tells us so much. And I think we've lost the art of history. I know, you know, my team, we have like a 32-page questionnaire before you even get to talk to us. And that's because we need history. We need to know what happened and a timeline of what happened so that we can see what we're talking to you about today. So I think, you know, as consumers, as clients, we all have that responsibility to, you know, give information in order to get information.
So you had been talking about mold, and maybe you can talk about how mold affects the body and how dangerous it is, and how, you know, modern society is actually having a tendency to create, you know, environment that have more mold than they should.
Okay, well, mold. Oh my God. It is, you know, one of the most robust substances in the world. And, you know, it's used in medicine and it's used in warfare for very good reasons. And that is, it is a complete immune suppressor. So mold's whole role in the world is to survive. And it doesn't care if you do or not, because you're just the host. It'll just decompose you eventually and move on to the next thing. So, you know, we've created these homes that are airtight and, you know, look beautiful, but there's no airflow. We're putting heaters on. We're cooking inside the home. We've got running water. So we've got condensation happening. And we're allowing that to be part of our daily lives and expecting it to have, you know, no consequence. Well, the consequence is mold. And once mold is in your environment, you're breathing it in, you're getting it on your skin, and you're getting the spores. And so, you know, you can leave your moldy environment and take the mold with you, because it's already in your nasal cavity. It's in your soft furnishings. It's in your clothes. You know, it's, like I say, it's a great survivor, and it will do what it needs to travel and to exist. So I think it's become a really big problem. And with foods, you know, two of the most addictive foods are coffee and chocolate. Well, the whole growth procedure of coffee beans and cacao is that those seed pods can harbor mold. And then we're processing that, and we're processing the mold with the coffee and the chocolate. And so, you know, we've become addicted to foods that are highly mold stimulated or mold harboring foods. So I think it's quite an insidious pathogen, and certainly not looked at enough.
So you're thinking that the coffee and the chocolate that everybody anybody has, you know, Costco anywhere, is such a, you know, a big part of like the corporate culture. It's kind of like, oh, you got to have that coffee break. You be in the coffee room, you get in the morning, you get in the afternoon, you do it. And like, it's being told, you're being, you know, whether you're getting it, you know, that way, you're getting it through some kind of soft drink that they infuse with it now. It's just like everywhere.
It's everywhere. It is mold harboring. So, you know, do we know every single coffee bean grown and processed has mold? No, but there's a very high incidence of it. So, you know, we really have to look at not only the big agenda behind it all, but how do we get to a place where coffee became such a world addiction, when tea can be grown very cleanly, has so many medicinal benefits. You can, you know, have all sorts of different teas. Why isn't that as big like as coffee? Asia.
I lived
the Western world.
Well, I lived in Tokyo from 2004 to 2006, and I got like really into all the tea, because, you know, in Tokyo you have across, you know, pollination of like, you know, Chinese stuff. You had, you know, Korean, you know, things from all over Asia. And there were so many restaurants in Tokyo, I could get like all different types of green teas, all different types of Chinese teas. And they were, you know, I was talking to some of my Japanese counterparts, and they had like a lot of medicinal practices. I would actually go to dinner at a Japanese house, and then they made me really awesome, you know, really awesome meals. But they always had different types of teas. And then I learned from my Japanese coworkers, like, you know, in the morning they had different types of teas, in the afternoon and at dinner when I went to their house. There's so many different varieties, and I got really into it. And I was like, wow. And you didn't really see people going to Starbucks as much.
Exactly.
You know,
but it's not even just the cup of tea. It's the process of it. It's the process of steeping it. It's the ceremonies, the tea ceremonies. Yeah. It wasn't just a matter of put a tea bag in a cup, boil the kettle, pour it in, there's your tea. There was the whole, you know, the love and the emotion and the like the ceremony behind it. Where is that when you're going to Starbucks or 7-Eleven?
Well, it was I went over a Japanese co-worker's house, and they had that tea ceremony, and they had the very ornate, you know, devices and how they steeped it, and everybody had different things coming down from their family that might, you know, be really old, like practices they're coming from their great-great-grandparents, you know, and the whole family had a certain way of doing something, or they actually used a certain family's tea because they had a whole history, and then they had like everything tied to that, and you could go back really far, and you're like, wow, a lot more going on here. You know. But yeah, it seems to be a lot more healthy. That, you know, when I was in Japan, I did feel better. For this, because I was eating more fish and more veggies, less red meat, and I walked a lot, because everything was like public transportation. So I was end up, you know, taking a train, but then I was walking like 2-3 miles all the time, like every day, because they didn't have a car. I was just big city. But it felt really cool. I mean, I was weird because they had areas where you could do Tai Chi during the day for your mental health. It was like you could go out during the middle of a hard work day and then go to this kind of temple area, and everybody's doing Tai Chi, people are meditating. It's just a different type of a life. Even though it was a rat race, it had places where you could go take a break and actually do breathing exercise. And I think that's very important, where we don't really do that here in the West. But
you know, there's a lot of different cultures around the there's a lot of different cultures around the world that have these wonderful practices of nurturing the body and the soul. You know, you've got the Tai Chi in Asia, you've got the siesta in South America and, you know, other countries. And we don't do that. You know, even in good old France, they have their main meal at lunchtime. Everyone gets together and has a main meal and then a snack in the evening before bed. How did in Australia and England and the US in particular, and I'm not just singling them out, but as an example, How did we get to this lifestyle of, you know, it was 9 to 5, now it's like 7 till 7, but how do we get to drive to a job, be in the job all day, have a coffee break or a smoko break, have a lunch that you're bolting down, it's probably a convenience food, work more with people that you probably don't like in an office, then commute home for 1 to 2 hours in a vehicle, and then quickly rush see your family for an hour before bedtime. How do we get to that? You know, how do we allow this to happen when there are so many other cultures where family is important, where the food is a ceremony, where there's a siesta, where there's an, you know, exercise period during the day that is vital for the body and mind, where there's tea ceremonies. Like, there's so much that in the Western world we've let go. We've thought it's unimportant or there's no time for it. I think we've really done ourselves a disservice.
Well, I think what happened is, like, you know, I've been in the corporate role. I'm in IT, and I've been able to carve out like a work from home. And because I'm an IT professional, I got to the point where I can very much do my work day however I want. So if in the middle of the day I want to go and do 2 hours worth of exercise, I can go do that. I can go off and go mountain bike, and I live in a place where I can do that. And as long as I get my work done, they don't care when it gets done. So it kind of puts me in a different type of zone where I had been in the world where I had the 2 hour commute back and forth. And I'm stuck in a bus, I'm stuck on a train, I'm stuck having to do that. You know, get home at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night. How much time do you have to relax or even talk to your kids? It's like you're on the train. They want you on the train. They want you on this kind of so into the corporate world you don't care about your own stuff. Mm-hmm. Where now I do my own art, I do music. I as long as I get my 8 hours in, I can do however I want to do it. And I love that I can, since I'm working at home, I can do better things for myself. I can make myself a meal. I can make myself breakfast. I don't have to buy some ready thing. I can go in or make, I can actually go and cook my dinner and not have to go and get some prepackaged thing and run it and wolf it down. Where I can actually sit with my family and talk. You know, that's not the way they want it. They want me on the in that 2 hour commute. But it's like, a lot of us are rebelling. It's like, why do I have to do that? I don't have to do that. I don't need to be in that office.
Exactly. And I think I
can work
all the listeners can. Yeah, I think all the listeners can modify their life. If you are in a job where you have to commute and you have to be, you know, in an environment locked up there for 6 to 8 hours, and then you have to commute back, make that work for you. It could be as simple as on the commute, do some education or do some meditation, download, you know, a podcast or download an audio book or, you know, listen to some meditation and do something for you. Make that time work for you. And if you are able to restructure your day or work from home or, you know, cook a meal the night before and take some quality food in with you, do something for yourself. There's a lot of small tweaks and changes we can make to make our lives work for ourselves. I'm lucky enough, you know, with the whole craziness of the world the past few years, I actually closed my clinics and it was the best thing I ever did. I now work from home. You know, I'm open to clients, but in the middle of the day, my diary will say out of office. Why is that? It's because I'm going for an 8 kilometer walk, or it's because I'm going for a bike ride with my sons, or, you know, I'm doing some training with my kitten, or I'm doing something, or I'm going for a bush walk. I don't have to be available all the time for everyone. And that's something I had to learn. And it's certainly something everyone else can put into place in their own lives, even to a small extent. You can make healthy changes along the way.
Even when I used to have to go into Boston, because I was a cancer survivor, I basically told my workplace, I'm going to take an extended lunch and I'm going to walk in the park. And I would go and I'd walk for like an hour. And I had some bosses that were like, oh, that's not what. I said, hey, I'm still getting 8 hours in. Don't worry about it. But this is something I got to do. And I just said, you know, that's what it's going to be. And it's not negotiable. I'm doing it. Right. And so sometimes you just got yourself to say, hey, these are my boundaries. You guys can say what you want. And I know what you want from me as a worker, but I have to do stuff that's good for me. Yep, and I'll keep me out definitely. Of, you know, in less sick time if you let me do what I'm doing. You know, and I actually got a boss that said, you know, Jones, like, since you did that, I started doing that. And I got like better productivity. I said, oh, that's amazing, right?
I wonder, right?
But yeah, it's interesting what you can do by just standing up. But so one of the things that I think you mentioned here that's interesting is like, what medical or pathogenic interventions can destroy my immune system? So maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, look, we live in an age right now where the immune system is a dirty word, but we actually do have one. Like I said, it has two levels to it. Pathogenic action is things like viral cells. Now, you cannot actually catch a virus. You already have those cells within you. Okay, you have the RNA of viral cells within you. What happens when we get sick is we can activate a virus. And so viruses are generally expressions of some form of toxicity that is feeding this particular cell cluster, and bam, we're unwell. Okay. We have bacteria. Not all bacteria are bad. In fact, there's a whole lot of bacteria in our gut that create our neurotransmitters, our feel-good neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine and GABA and acetylcholine. And, you know, that all starts in the gut. And of course, these bacteria also create melatonin so that we have a good night's sleep. So we really have to look at not everything is good and bad. It's a bit of both. And then we have fungus. So, you know, we know one of the prime fungal pathogens is candida. In the modern medical world, they talk about one candida, but there's 470 of them. They're not all bad. We talk about inflammation. Not all inflammation is bad, because from inflammation, you create a healing response. It's when you have an over-exaggeration of inflammation that you've got an inflammatory response. So, you know, there's that. There's, you know, also minerals and vitamins and things like that that we so often leave out of our lives, but we need them. And so when we're looking at the immune system, there's, you know, the pathogenic action can vary greatly depending on the nutrition that we have, depending on our lifestyle. You know, there's so much to it. And when it comes to medical intervention, don't even get me started. You cannot bypass the innate immune system and expect a great outcome. Now, I'm not going to say the word because I'm just not going to, but we need to look at germ theory versus terrain theory. So germ theory is I introduce a part of the germ and you create antibodies and then you have some protection. Okay. If you are introducing it beyond the innate immune system, you cannot actually create natural antibodies. You are better off activating the pathogen, letting your immune system do its job, creating antibodies, and then you're okay. Because what happens with viruses is they morph. And so the thing that I'm not going to say, when you're introducing a particular strain to the body, bypassing the innate immune system, you're introducing an alpha strain. By the time that viral cell has morphed and replicated within you, it could be the beta or the gamma or the delta or whatever strain. It's no longer what you put into your body bypassing your innate immune system. So it makes no sense. Whereas if you activate it naturally, your antibodies will cover you. So that's germ theory. Terrain theory is we treat the body. We treat the body systems and we create a healthy terrain so that when this pathogen is activated, our body knows what to do. So as I said, natural antibodies. So, you know, there's a lot going on there, but you cannot, I'm going to say inject. You cannot inject something and expect that to save you from something. Your body still has to have a response. And if you cut out the first layer of defense, being the innate immune system, the response isn't going to be as great.
So that's interesting. I won't get totally into the whole idea like vaccines and stuff, it's like political, but you know, with different people, but I do understand what you're saying. So in terms of other types of what recommended behaviors in given the modern world, what would be like the top like thing that you would recommend to somebody if you were going to give like an elevator conversation and introduce somebody into holistic natural health? What's the top thing that you would say? What's the first thing you would tell somebody?
First thing is identify the root cause of any illness. Look at your history or get a practitioner on board that can do that and identify the root cause. Nothing happens without a reason. Okay, so there's always a root cause. The second is treat the whole body. Holism is treating all 13 systems of the body. It's looking at the whole body. It's looking at the mind. It's looking at the emotions, the spiritual self. It's looking at self and non-self cells. It's holism. Do not treat in reductionism. Do not say, I have a runny nose. That is the problem, because that's reductionism thinking. Look at, why is my nose running? What is going on in my body? Do I have the right balance of vitamins and minerals? Are the systems of my body working into it with each other? Is my runny nose an emotional response to something? So there's the difference between holism and reductionism.
Yeah, because something could be like psycho, you know, I guess it's like it's not actually is more like in your head causing to do something, because psychology is very powerful.
So yeah, so it comes back to
you can have a soul. Yeah,
it comes back to the PNEI system. You know, I've spoken on other podcasts about public speaking as an example. Okay, you have to give a talk tomorrow and it's in front of 10,000 people. Okay, your immediate thought, so the P is, I can't talk in front of 10,000 people. Okay, I don't want to do this. I'm scared. So that's the psycho. The neuro is, all of a sudden you start getting aches and pains and numbness in the fingers and you ignore that message. The E is, all of a sudden you're feeling really queasy. It's coming up. It's now tomorrow morning. It's coming up and you're like, oh, I'm dizzy. I'm queasy. I'm hot. I'm clammy. I'm sweating. That's the E. The I, you're about to walk onto the stage and all of a sudden your nose is running. You feel like you're full up with a head cold. That's the I. It's trying to keep you safe. All these things are keeping you safe. Okay. And that is the body's role. And that is all the body system's role, is to keep you safe from perceived danger. Now, the perceived danger is the talk. The P is the thought that's come. The N, the E, the I. So all of a sudden, you're about to walk on stage. You've got a runny nose. You're dizzy. You're sweating. You know, skin's clammy. And you've got, you know, some sort of pain down your sciatic nerve or numbness in your fingers, and you're freaking out. There's the PNEI at work.
Well, it seems like one of the things of like Eastern practices would seem to be able to ease that, if you could, you know, calm yourself and meditate and you know, get yourself to a point where you're not so being obsessive about it that you trigger all these things. While I was living in Tokyo, was the fact that I got into meditation. I got into like Buddhist chanting, and I started, you know, every day I chant like two, three times a day. Yeah. And, you know, control my breath control. And it really has made me less of what I was when I was 26 or 27. I've been able to be more calm and have some peace of mind, even if things are going crazy around me. I found that these Eastern practices allowed me to center myself and not get affected as much. Not that I don't get affected, but I can control my responses by being in a more calming state.
Exactly. Something happened to me yesterday. I was, you know, rushing and I was watching a live YouTube and I accidentally pasted a comment and I think I deleted it because I can't find it anyway. But, you know, I was freaking out. Going, oh my God, you know, it was meant for someone else. And, oh, what am I doing? And then I kind of thought about it and I turned to my son and said, we need to go for an hour's walk. And he said, now? And I went, yep, right now. So we did, and then we went and had a look at a mob of kangaroos that lived near us, and I calmed myself and I centered myself. It had just started raining, so, you know, the essential oils were being released from the trees around us, and when I came home, I wasn't freaking out anymore. So, you know, we need to do little things to take ourselves out of that stress response. Sometimes we can't completely stop it, but we can certainly jump into ways to protect ourselves from it.
Yeah, because it's like that adrenaline thing can lead a lot of people to have adrenaline issues nowadays because of the fight or flight type of situation of modern day life is triggering it for all these like sociological and psychological issues where you don't have the wolf or the tiger coming down from a psychological standpoint because you got to do that speech. You got to bully. Bothering you. You got all these social interactions that can trigger that just as much as if you were getting attacked by a wolf.
That's it. But now we're being attacked by the wolf and the tiger all the time. And it starts with our alarm going off in the morning. And then it's our calendar. And then it's the commute to work. And then it's working. And then it's, you know, oh my God, the family. And now I've got to do the shopping. And what's my bank balance doing? And, you know, so there's a wolf and a tiger chasing us all the time now. And we really need to detach from that as much as we can and find these practices that work for us, whether it's going for a walk, whether it's meditating, whether it's just doing some breathing exercises. You know, we have to do something.
Yeah, I started to, like, I have a stand-up desk and I actually have, like, a stepper. And so during the day, instead of being in an office, you know, for many, many years, I had some problems with my back. And then I talked to a chiropractor and he said, you know what, you need to get a stand-up desk and you need to have like a stepper and actually move. Don't be sitting all day as a tech. You know, I mean, the problem with being in tech, you can get lost in code and you'll be sitting for like 6 hours straight and not get up. Where if you switch to a stand-up, a stepper or like a treadmill, then you actually introduce good behaviors and you're doing your work and you're not away from your desk, but you're able to do two things at once, exercise and exactly. Work. And my diabetic numbers and everything.
Just on the other side of my desk, like exit stage left, there's a rebounder trampoline. And in between calls and sometimes even on calls, because I have very long cord on my headphones, I'm on my rebounder. So sometimes people I'm working, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I think it's just good to introduce movement, you know, just being able to move your body more. You know, I end up looking at my watch and it's like oh, I have 2 miles just being at my stand-up desk by moving like side to side and doing it. It's actually tracking me moving. And yeah. And it's actually making my numbers way better for my A1C and stuff. And it's like, you know, you tell people who are just sitting at the desk and they're sitting in, you know, in a bad position and they're wondering why their back's hurting. And, but, you know, you're not doing something that's good for you.
Exactly.
But we are at the top of that hour. I really enjoyed this conversation. It's something that's really, I think a lot of people need to do the research and check out the website we have here. This will be clickable when we get fully published on Facebook and YouTube and Spotify and Apple. You'll be able to click on that link and check out your process. And that will actually bring them to your health assessment form.
Yes. Yep. So you can request a health assessment, which is our root cause analysis. And as I said, when we see that booking is through, We send you the history form. We do this around the world. So if you're not in Australia, don't worry. We can do it all via Zoom. And yeah, definitely get onto that link.
Well, thank you very much. I think this is very helpful. I think there's a lot of people that will be able to benefit from your holistic natural health process and the process you have, and then the healing remedies that you can provide to people, and the analysis, because you ask the questions, which I think is, you know, getting that kind of customization is very important today. And the fact that you're offering that, I think our listeners will appreciate it. And I hope everybody takes part and check it out. And thank you again for being on the show. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.